Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you feel about your car? Is it just a way to get around, an environmentally costly, necessary evil? Or does driving offer a bit of a thrill, a matchless source of independence, even a way to communicate your identity? How can we make cars better? Or is it possible most of us could live pretty well without driving at all? We've been wrestling with these questions about cars a lot over the past few years. But as my guest today will explain, the consternation over our relationship to our vehicles is as old as the technology that makes them possible. Brian Ladd is an independent historian with a PhD from Yale. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. Brian, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon.
You write that cars have a long history of success coupled with denial. Can you talk about that?
Well, it seems to me that we love our cars. Some of us really love our cars. Some of us really hate cars. And most of us are a good bit of both. So that cars have been very practical, but they've also satisfied emotional needs. But they're the kind of emotional needs that we're not exactly proud of sometimes, at least. And so both on the practical level of how we arrange our cities and also on the emotional level, we have very mixed feelings about cars. I think most of us individually do, as well as collectively as a society.
Well, it's such an interesting point, because even people who say that they're not fond of cars, most of them in most cities in this country have cars anyway.
Right. There is the notion that you can't live a normal life if you don't have a car, and there's a lot of truth to that in most parts of this country, and to a lesser extent in a lot of other places in the world. So you can tolerate your car, but you can also appreciate it, even if you don't like it in some sense. If you disapprove of it as polluting and so forth, you can still appreciate the thrill of it, appreciate the ability to get to places that you wouldn't be able to get to otherwise.
In the beginning, I guess cars were chiefly seen as playthings for the super rich. How did they tend to use them?
In the beginning, it was typically wealthy people who lived in cities would use them for country outings, perhaps to their country houses, most typically in a place like England, but also in this country, or for racing down country roads, perhaps for organized auto racing, but also just for racing down country roads, which is where they started getting into trouble with the rural people who didn't like that.
Yeah, nobody wanted automobiles through their fields or down their sleepy country roads.
Right. We still have a problem of cars killing lots of small animals. And from the beginning, it was typically farm dogs and farm chickens that were used to wandering all over the roads.
And so people would go to great and sometimes murderous lengths to express how much they hated cars and drivers.
Right. In this phase, typically a rural phenomenon, it lasted for a pretty short period in the U.S., for longer in Europe, when cars were rich people from the city, country people, poor people didn't have them. And so people would blockade roads, farmers would organize to dig up roads and trap cars in ditches, or the most typical thing was to throw rocks. It was usually boys, but it happened enough that I think their parents didn't mind boys throwing rocks at cars. And then also there's the favorite farmer's weapon of the bucket of fresh dung.
Did anybody at that point really expect that cars would take over as a primary means of transportation?
There were a few people, and I suppose you'd call them the visionaries, who said from the beginning, this is going to take over. And yet, I think nobody really did, and that's why at what may be another end of the automobile age where we are now, it's hard to imagine how much they took over, because originally they were just a substitute for the horse-drawn carriage. A faster substitute. I mean, the idea of the horseless carriage is very real. And to a lesser extent for bicycles, which were also used for country recreation. But they took over for trains. They took over for lots of other modes of transportation as well that we didn't expect from the beginning. You know, they took over from streetcars that nobody thought that at the beginning.
So one of the next big waves of drivers after the super wealthy was doctors, who made the case that cars would get them to sick patients faster and more efficiently. Did that start to change public perception of the value of cars?
Definitely. In part for the obvious reason, if, if the doctor gets there at what seems like incredible speed in the middle of the night, you're going to be grateful not only to the doctor but to the car, and partly because some of these doctors took it upon themselves to be propagandists for the automobile, both because it enabled them to do just that, to get around quickly, but also they started saying things that sound pretty strange to our ears about what a wonderful form of exercise it is for, you know, just turning that steering wheel and getting fresh air. Of course, these would have been usually open cars at the beginning. And they were actually doctors saying that this is the greatest thing for exercise, because they assumed that people walked anyway, and so this would be something a bit different. It never occurred to them that we would give up walking and spend all our time in cars.
Yeah, you have a great quote in there about somebody saying that it's actually better for you exercise-wise to drive a car than it is to walk the equivalent distance.
Right, because you use your legs on the pedals and you use your arms on the steering wheel, and so it's all body exercise. That's the theory.
Many generations of Americans can prove that's not actually true. What changed, Brian, when cars were suddenly available to the middle class?
Well, what changed, obviously, in terms of attitudes, if you were pro or anti-car, it would be for very different reasons. I mean, to some extent, the snobbery ultimately reversed itself so that the cars were a thing for the masses, and so a certain snobs would say it's the toy of the ordinary people. And the other thing that changed fundamentally was how we organize our lives in our cities. When it's just a few people who have cars, it messes up country roads and runs over chickens, but it doesn't change the way we organize our lives as a society. But when lots of people have cars, you have traffic jams downtown, you have to figure out where to park them and so forth.
Yeah, and there's even the idea, you know, you talk about the organization of cities. You can compare a city like Phoenix that has essentially always had cars as a component of the way it was planned as compared with, you know, a smaller city in Europe or somewhere.
Exactly, yeah, that we have built our cities around cars in the United States more than anywhere else in the world, and other places to a considerable extent. And as a place like Phoenix is a good example because it became a city with cars. Older cities have had more difficult conflicts because they've had to figure out how to fit cars into cities that weren't built for them.
And cars early on even had an impact on the sorts of things that women would wear.
Right, because if you think back to 1900, I mean, the changes were going on anyway in terms of the move away from what we would call Victorian clothing for women. I wish I had a number here. If you add up all the things that a lady, this is a class thing, a middle-class lady would have had to wear to step out onto the street, the total poundage of it was really quite astonishing. These women could not have been weak. But you have to shed a certain amount of that in order to be able to move around enough to, you know, manipulate the foot pedals in a car.
So the hemlines came up and the skirts were a little narrower.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When did people first start to notice the link between automobiles and aggression?
Oh, at the very beginning. Once you see somebody roaring down your country road, or also from the beginning, it's important that auto racing was central, because that was when it was a toy, that was what the toy was for a lot of people. And racing has a lot to do with aggression, right, getting out in front of other people. And so people saw that from the very beginning. And also, I mean, this is one of the things that astonished me in doing my research, is that to the extent to which already 100 years ago, people, at least some perceptive and articulate observers, had figured out everything that we associate with a term like road rage. They had observed that and decided that there was something about getting behind the wheel of a car. And again, you go back to your Victorian lady. I mean, this was the image that was very striking at the time. You take your proper prim Victorian lady, put her behind the wheel of a 1903 curved dash Oldsmobile, and she becomes a maniac.
Brian Ladd is my guest. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. What about the link between cars and sex? That was also pretty early.
Very early. I mean, there were songs. What's the one about the Oldsmobile? Now I've forgotten my merry Oldsmobile. That really, if you look at the lyrics, they were pretty clear about the sexual connotations of, you know, come away with me in my car and we'll fly away and you know, you can go as far as you like with me in my merry Oldsmobile. It was clear both in terms, I think, of the sense of aggression and expression and power, but also in a more practical sense in that it provided a place for young men and women together or alone to get away from the family to places that otherwise would not have been available to them, and to get a privacy that otherwise would not have been available to them.
Sure, so they can get physically away, and then they have this little space that invites all sorts of licentious behavior.
Exactly. We know that story, but it's older than we might have thought.
Did that surprise you when you started to research this book, that in fact it's been the entire century of automobile history that we've had the same arguments that we're having today?
Yeah, well, as a historian, I thought I was going to set out all of the different eras of arguments against the car, because that's the way it's arranged, as a history of arguments against the car, hostility to the car. And I thought I would say, you know, the ones that appeared in 1910, the ones that appeared in 1930, and so forth. But ultimately, that all broke down because I found that most of the arguments were really already fully fledged by 1910.
Cars were recognized early on as being potentially deadly. It's interesting, though, that at first the onus was completely on the drivers. Can you talk about the campaigns that were undertaken to get them to use caution?
Right. Well, that's a long and complicated history that, of course, is still very much with us. And I think it relates to this sense of aggression and freedom, perhaps in the bad sense, that people seem to get behind the wheel of a car. And so you had the rich young men or women running down the chickens and the dogs in the country road, and the country people unhappy about that. And sure, they would throw rocks, but they would also try to pass laws and enlist the policemen. And so, again, we've had more than 100 years of this cat-and-mouse game between drivers and forces of authority, police officers, that, I mean, I think that's still true for most of us middle-class people today. Our awareness of and contact with the police is through our capacity as motorists, and that was true in 1910 as well, when they were passing the first speed limits, when they were figuring out the idea of a speed trap to catch unwary motorists and try to slow them down, or perhaps at least fine them and get some money off of that. It was all very much in the air.
Yeah. How long did it take for someone to realize that laws were going to be a huge part of all of this?
Well, it was there from the very beginning. I mean, it's sort of one thing added to another, because when people see a problem that they think is a problem of minority, naturally they're going to go to their city council, state legislature, whatever, and say we should pass a law against this new problem. And so there were, as I say, things like speed limits and various prohibitions on certain kinds of driving that were already being passed in the 1890s with the very first cars. And I would say by the 19 teens and 20s, you already had full-fledged codes of laws dealing with motorists, because there were enough cars and enough awareness of this that everybody knew this is something we're going to have to control forever.
When did automobile insurance come about?
That depends on the country, and in the U.S. it depends on the state, so I can't give you a year. But again, in the very early years of the 1900s, people were talking about that. And it went along with other laws, which go along with what I was just talking about, licensing drivers and licensing automobiles. And at some point, that became coupled with what we're familiar with today, is in order to license your car, you have to have liability insurance, typically. And so those laws came on. It was a gradual process, but it goes back to, I'd say, to around 1910 and then builds from there.
Brian Ladd is my guest. He's a historian whose new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. We'll talk more after this break, including about Ralph Nader and Unsafe at Any Speed. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Brian Ladd. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 to get on the line, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So we talked about the rise of laws to govern drivers and the way they drive. Automakers initially successfully convinced themselves, if not everybody else, that safe doesn't sell. What were they paying attention to?
Well, this is particularly true in the 1950s, which was, of course, the great boom era for the American auto industry, which they're still hoping will return and hasn't for 50 years. This was the era in which they all went whole hog for the idea of the annual styling change, the really flashy chrome, the tail fin, that, you know, the American automakers were doing that, and nearly all the cars on the market were enormous, and they changed the style every year to try to encourage people to trade in their cars every year because it was a fashion thing, and they put a lot of money into the styling stuff, and somehow they thought that consumer pressure wasn't there to make the cars more practical, and the idea of safety didn't have anything to do with the car. Safety was about roads, it was about drivers, but it wasn't about cars. That was the thinking that was, in fact, funded by these auto industry-supported safety foundations. And so they managed to divert from other people's minds, but also from their own minds, the idea that they could make the cars safer. And the safety doesn't sell came in the mid-50s. Ford actually changed course briefly and offered a package of safety options, radical things like seat belts. And the marketing people decided that the sales results of that were not good enough. They weren't really that bad. And so they convinced themselves safety doesn't sell, and everybody agreed to that for several more years.
It sounds like the salad bar at Wendy's. There just wasn't a huge profit to be made, I guess, and so they got rid of it.
Right.
So later you have Ralph Nader coming along after the Chevy Corvair comes out. Can you talk about the impact of Nader on the way, not just the car companies, but everybody in America started thinking about cars?
And, of course, he didn't do it himself, but I mean, we can name Nader because he's still around and he's still annoying people in perhaps good and bad ways. But there were a number of legislators who had hearings, and Nader actually managed to get into this business by working for a Senate committee that was doing hearings in the early 60s. But he also did his own research, particularly, as you mentioned, about the Chevrolet Corvair, which was a particularly clear case of, in this case, General Motors engineers knowing about the unsafe aspects in the handling of the Corvair and the design of it and being told not to talk about it and not to fix it because they didn't want to spend the money on that. And he wrote this famous book, 1965, Unsafe at Any Speed, that starts out with this sensational chapter about the Corvair and then talks about other cars and other problems as well. And that really got people's attention and enabled the Congress then to start passing some safety laws.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Brian Ladd. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Great topic, as always, and a very ironic one, considering kind of what's going on in Washington with the big three right now.
Right.
My kind of point was about the cars. I'm so fascinated with cars in this country, is that I lived in a couple of cities that really depended very heavily on public transportation. And in one of the cities, I had no car, and so I just depended on it completely, like a lot of people did. And I can tell you that I've never had the sense of calm and relaxation in the form of travel that I did when I would get on a train or a bus and was able to sit down or even stand and read a book and start a conversation. Now, it, of course, it still had its own, you know, stressors and all the rest of that, but I just never, ever have the same sense of calm, you know, that I did when I was on a train or a bus. And particularly in a city like this that I've lived in for about 5 years, what I found interesting is that there is still very much so a sense of class distinction in terms of public transportation versus the car. I've had so many different conversations with people in this city, and it becomes very apparent that public transportation is for the poor, and that the car is for those who are of another class. And I find that very interesting about this place, and just wondered if he had had any of similar experiences, and also to comment on this idea of public transportation versus riding around in the wonderful streets of Dallas in a car.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Well, Tim raises very important points here. I happen to be with him on enjoying public transportation, although, of course, I'm sure I could come up with a long list of bad experiences on public transportation in different places. There will always be other people who will enjoy driving in a car, but I think there are some people who are deceiving themselves or you know, sort of putting up with the stresses of driving because they think they have to, which gets to the status question that he also raised, that you know, there are a lot of us who arrive at work after our commutes in our car and you know, are not really in the calmest of moods. And in fact, I think a lot of the cases we get out of the car and think, gee, I'm glad my mother wasn't watching. But that suggests that, as I say, the issue of status that he points to, that there is this sense that you can't take the bus because the bus is for poor people and it would just look bad, which reminds us that this funny thing about the car is, on the one hand, it's extremely practical in some ways, but on the other hand, it's a matter of status and fashion, and we mix these things up all the time. But what we've done, and this is very important historically, what we've done is that we've let this combination of practicality and status drive the way we've designed our cities. And so we've made it ever more practical to drive by building highways, by not expanding transit systems, by suburban sprawl that's such that you really can't get around without a car. You can't walk. You can't have buses or trains. And so we've taken away the choice that we might have had. And people will say that's practical. And in some ways, it is practical. In some ways, suburban sprawl is more practical than you know, living in a densely packed city. But in some ways, it's also been driven by this idea that you got to have a car if you're going to be middle class. You got to have a car if you're going to be respectable. Which raises the question for the future is then, you know, the way we build our cities isn't going to change rapidly. We've got the cities we have. But if the fashion changes, will the practicality follow?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Yeah. I'm sort of a fan of, there's a musician here from Texas called Terry Allen, and he writes about, he calls it outlaw radio or the Del Rio blowtorch, Wolfman Jack, and he's from Lubbock, and the sad song Amarillo Highway, which has been covered, but writes a lot about the freedom of being able to get out of a small town, imperfect lovers having affairs on the outskirts of town in a hotel, and girls coming of age on in the back seat, and sort of American graffiti type of story. Do you get into that, or?
That's not an example. That particular music that I cover in the book, I cover a little bit of the popular culture. There's so much. That's a great example. But I mean, when you look at American music, American literature, American movies, it's just everywhere in one way or another. Because of course, we not only do we spend a lot of time in our cars, we invest a lot of our hopes in our cars. Hopes for love, for passion, for excitement, for escape. And so it's everywhere you turn. And I try to touch on a little of that. And that's, you know, that's become so much a part of the way we think about America. But it also it goes back to some of the paradoxes I was just talking about, because you know, we get in our car and go to work, and we hope that our drive to work will bring a little bit of that spark, maybe a little bit of love, a little bit of excitement. But usually it just brings us a traffic jam.
I guess in the very beginning, Brian, cars basically all sort of looked alike. At what point, though, did they start to reflect our style and, as you say, the fashion, more than simply our ability to afford a particular model?
Well, that goes back way back to the beginning, too. It takes a more practiced eye to look at cars from 1910 and realize that fashion distinctions that would have been very important to people at the time, but you and I think they all look like cars from 1910. But it's always been there because they were rich people's toys. And so there were the rich people, and then there were the richer people who could have even bigger cars. And so size has had a lot to do with it from time to time. But obviously also there have been other aspects of it, too. Speed has had something to do with it. And you know, the fashions have kept changing, but it's always been there because cars have always been status symbols.
You make the point, too, and I think it's really interesting, that fundamentally cars really haven't changed very much at all since 1910.
Right. They look different in a superficial way, but this is the way I organize my book, because this reflects, you know, my having read hundreds of books about cars, and you know, most of them are, you know, celebrations of, you know, the Corvette or the Jaguar or XJ or whatever else. But as someone who is not a car nut in that sense, and I couldn't, you know, I'm helpless under the hood, I'm struck by how similar they are, that they're, you know, you've got these gasoline-powered internal combustion engines with a couple of variations, like the diesel. You've got four wheels, you've got a metal box, and they're basically the same idea for 100 years now.
Car ownership rates sort of caught on faster in the United States than in Europe, even once the technology was available equally in both places. Can you talk about how that really did set up our cultures on separate trajectories since maybe the end of the Second World War?
Well, one of the things you see there is, of course, that's part of America leading the world in terms of fashion trends and popular culture. And it has to do, a lot of it, simply with the prosperity of the American working class throughout most of the 20th century compared to other places. There was such a difference so that ordinary people could afford cars, and in other countries they could only dream about it until the last third of the 20th century, roughly speaking. And so it creates this situation where Americans at least seem to be living the reality of what the rest of the world dreams of, and that's, of course, magnified by things like American movies. I mean, the joke is that the film The Grapes of Wrath from the 1930s, I don't know if this is true, I've never followed this up, was shown in the Soviet Union by the propagandists to show that Americans were miserably poor and suffering, but what ordinary people did was they said poor people have cars in America. So there's that, but then there's also the fact that as a result of that, we could build our cities around cars. We, by the 1950s, were doing all of our city planning and building on the assumption that every family had a car, which was never the case, but it was a majority, solid majority by then, and that was nowhere near a majority anywhere else. And so that created a real divergence that has remained, even as other wealthy countries like in Europe and Japan have begun to catch up in terms of car ownership. The way they've organized their lives around it has never been as extreme.
You say it's important to remember that automotive technology is both socially and politically constructed. What does that mean?
Well, what is important is that I think when we look at the history of technology, of machines, the temptation is to say somebody invented this machine, whether it was invented by, you know, Daimler and Benz in Germany or perfected by Henry Ford in the Model T, and by virtue of the strength of this machine, our world was changed. And there's something to that. But what happens is these machines come along to suit desires and wishes that are already there, and then our desires and wishes get all mixed up with the machines, and power and status and fashion all get mixed up with the machines. And so it's impossible to say whether the machines have changed our world or whether we have used the machines to change our world or what.
We've talked a little bit about how we set up infrastructure in order to accommodate driving, and obviously a lot of people have moved out to the suburbs because there are good roads and wide streets. Even though our garage-first homes, the things that are built these days, sort of speaks to how much we value cars.
Exactly. I mean, that's a very striking image if you think about it, that sure, we can all think of places that we drive past regularly, you know, particularly in sort of more densely built-up new suburban areas, where you go down the street and all you see is a row of garage doors, which some people deplore as ugly. I think it's usually pretty ugly, too, and some people deplore as killing neighborhood sociability, because you drive up, you push your garage door open, you go in, And the garage door is all the world ever sees of your house. I mean, so on one level, it's just a visible statement of the way we live our lives, but on another level, it reflects something that some people would say we've lost by organizing our world in which we drive everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And you don't see any new houses built now, no matter how modest the house itself, without a two-car garage. There's no such thing as a new home with a one-car garage.
Maybe in some of the old cities, mm-hmm. but in general, no. In most of America, it's just assumed because we at some point made the transition from the idea that every family would have a car, which, as I say before, that was the assumption in the 50s, not quite the reality, to the assumption that every driver will have a car. And that's where we are now in the United States, that, once you turn 16, you get your car, and that's the way you get around. And if you don't drive, you are out of it.
What do we expect our cars to do for us besides getting us from point A to point B?
Well, we look to them for excitement. I mean, there is a visceral thrill in pushing that accelerator on an empty country road. Unfortunately, we tend to do it on a busy freeway, and then we get into trouble. The notion of it's part of our mating game, right? I mean, the sex appeal, I mean, we talked about that, is going way back in the century as well. There's still this notion that first men, and I think in recent years also women as well, feel like they have to have the cool kind of car because that's the first thing anybody's going to notice about them, because they're going to pull up in a car that's taken for granted in many places. And so you got to have the right kind of cool car to be attractive to possible romantic partners, but also to look good to your boss or to your subordinates. You have to have the right kind of car. It's got to be so. There's the practicality of transportation and getting away, but so much of it is status and fashion. And I don't mean to condemn that. That's just the reality. We're always going to have status and fashion. It's just that we have invested an awful lot of that in cars, and we pay, in many ways, a big price for that.
Historian Brian Ladd is my guest. We'll be back in just a moment to our discussion. We're talking about his book, Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Historian Brian Ladd is my guest. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Brian, is the health of the U.S. automotive industry in any way tied to the health or the ongoing viability of our car culture?
Well, in the long run, certainly, and probably in the short run as well. I mean, obviously, if Detroit collapses, I don't think it's going to happen, a complete collapse. But these days, unlike the 1950s, we've got lots of other foreign car makers, many of them with plants in this country, that can step in to fill the gap. But what has kept Detroit going more than the Japanese automakers has been the fashion side, the luxury side, particularly in recent years with the fad for the sport utility vehicle, the big vehicle, because that's how they found their niche, that's how they've made their money, and that niche seems to be closing. And so the question is, where are the fashions going to go from here, and is Detroit going to be able to chase them?
How did Detroit emerge as the U.S. capital for the auto industry?
If I could give a short answer to that, it's one of these fascinating accidents of history that happens when industries concentrate in certain places because there are advantages there. And it had to do in part with the fact, something as accidental as the fact that the buggy building industry depended on a ready supply of good forest wood and there happened to be a lot of that in Michigan. And so that was a well-established industry in Detroit, and that provided a lot of the infrastructure for the automobile manufacturers. It's that sort of accidental development, and that brings someone like Henry Ford, and his success brings competitors. And so it's a whole series of historical accidents that create that Detroit-centered, automobile-centered industrial belt.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Brett in Dallas. Hey, Brett.
Hi. I got a slightly orthogonal question here. Actually, a little background. I live in a motorhome, and I have a 52-year-old MG and a 6-year-old Saturn. But the question I wanted to ask was, comparing, you know, I'm driving the MG, driving the Saturn, I've got a huge difference. I see a huge difference in the reliability of the vehicles. I mean, the MG obviously is a difficult car to maintain at best, but I have a Saturn, and virtually all the new cars these days are similar. You basically take them in once a year for a checkup, put gas in them, and drive them. It's a huge difference in the way things were even 10 years ago, and definitely the way they were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Can I get a comment on how you guys see that as part of the way this industry has matured? Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
That's absolutely right, and it's easy for people, and I would include myself, who comment caustically on Detroit's failures to say that they churn out junk. But as Brett points out, the General Motors car that he has, really almost as much as the famously reliable Japanese cars. The difference these days is fairly small, certainly compared to the cars of the 1950s that were. It's true for the home-schooled mechanic, they were relatively easy to fix, but that was important because they needed to be fixed all the time. It is impressive, but that's where the talent has gone. We were talking earlier about how cars haven't changed that much over 100 years, but the advantage of that is that they've been able to take the same basic technology and make it better and better, and take the same basic assembly line techniques and make them better and better. And so it really is a very impressive piece of technology in that respect, and that goes along with the fact that we've made them such a central part of our lives so that we can count on our cars almost always to start up and get us where we want to go. On the other hand, there are ways in which cars are remarkably inefficient technology. I mean, if you take just the ratio of energy in the fuel to energy turned directly to the turning of the wheels and the efficiency of motion, cars don't measure up well compared to lots of other machines. And that's inherent in the technology as well. I mean, to say nothing, of course, of the fuel consumption, the pollution problem, that we've solved by a catalytic converter, which is in many ways a very inefficient way. I mean, instead of making them pollute less, we just clean up the pollution before it comes out the tailpipe, which is better than nothing. But it's an interesting set of paradoxes in the fact that we have relied on the same basic machine for 100 years.
An email from Ted in Fort Worth says, "One thing I've noticed is that even though technology has advanced in the auto industry, fuel economy has not. I'm the owner of a 1949 Ford pickup with a V8 flathead engine that will get you about 18 miles per gallon if you drive it moderately. In comparison, a brand new Ford F-150 with all the computers gets you no more miles per gallon and has less power. Did you find any particular reason for this sort of thing in your research?"
That's a tough one. I would not have been able to tell you any mile per gallon figures for cars from the 1940s. Obviously, both of those figures are unimpressive compared to many of the smaller cars that have been developed in the meantime, and certainly the hybrid cars we have these days. I mean, in both cases, you're talking about a very large vehicle, and so that's the main part of the answer there, is that those are very large vehicles designed either to carry a lot of freight and people or simply to be luxurious. And a pickup truck or an SUV is very heavy compared to a passenger car, and also aerodynamically, and this is probably part of the answer to his question, aerodynamically trucks are inherently inefficient. They sit up high, they've got a lot of square corners, so they've got to have huge engines to be able to perform in the ways people expect them to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bill in Fort Worth. Hey, Bill.
Yes, I was going to ask Mr. Ladd, if mass production, which began with Henry Ford or whomever started the mass production of vehicles, the cost of mass production is supposed to bring the price of the product down, whereas we're looking at the fact that you got $50,000, $60,000 for a Cadillac Escalade, I would think that they've produced enough of them that the cost would come down.
Well, of course, part of this is the reality of supply and demand in the market. A Cadillac Escalade, I mean, it may be a very fine vehicle. I've never driven one, but that's, you know, a pretty extreme case of a vehicle that is sold above all as a fashion item. And so as long as people are willing to pay that, they can get that for it. And people are willing to pay that because part of the status of a Cadillac Escalade is that it is expensive. And so it gets back to the element of fashion as well as the element of mass production. And this is, again, to get back to the problems of Detroit, what has sustained them over the past 10 years has been the fact that they've been able to sell SUVs at big profit margins. That's one of, you know, why has that happened? Because people have been willing to pay the price. I mean, I don't know how to explain it better than that.
It is sort of an interesting paradox that it's become very fashionable for even wealthy people to drive hybrids like the Prius. You'll see all these actors driving one. But you don't, again, going back to the call we had earlier, you don't necessarily see people of great means jumping on public transportation if they have other options.
Right. And, I mean, this is one of the questions for the future. It's someday cars will be less fashionable for fewer people. There are signs of that in other countries. And actually, go to New York. You do see people with money who ride public transportation, and there it's simply practical because in Manhattan, it's, you know, you get around faster on the subway. That's the only place in the U.S. really where that's true. If you go someplace like Tokyo or Paris, you find the same thing to an even greater degree. I mean, I've read, it's hard to measure these things, of trends in Tokyo where young people, well-to-do young people, are saying, cars aren't cool anymore, I don't need a car. But, of course, that's a city where you don't need a car. You can get around on clean, safe, fast mass transit. Now, if we built all that in this country and all our cities, would, you know, well-to-do people start taking it? Well, hard to say.
We've done some shows on this program about the sort of cultural battle between people who ride bicycles and people who use cars. I was very interested to read that before people were furious about the presence of automobiles, a lot of people were very upset by the existence of bicycles on their roads.
Right. That's one of the things that left me scratching my head as well, because, as you say, we're used to a cultural conflict that's going on these days between bicycles as a different kind of, an alternative kind of fashion statement, as well as alternative kind of practical transportation versus cars. But in fact, what you see historically is that the mechanical perfection of the bicycle predates the automobile just by a decade or so. And so in the 1880s, the hot new machine for wealthy people going out into the country from the cities was the bicycle. Within a few years, it was the car that came along and became far more fashionable, obviously for a much longer period of time. But in fact, in the beginning, they were both these rich people's toys that were seen as offending country ways. Not always. I mean, obviously, the bicycles were not quite the same threat. They weren't as noisy. They weren't as stinky, although they could still run people and animals down. But they were seen as young people, rich people showing off.
We have heard all the very real concerns about the sustainability in the developing world now that suddenly more and more people have access to cars. I wonder, though, if you can talk about how you think automobiles might, in fact, also change the developing world for the better.
For the better. Well, obviously, there is the possibility of them doing for developing countries what they have done for now a fairly long list of developed countries in which lots of people have cars, that they permit people to, I mean, they permit suburban sprawl in the good sense, and people getting out of extremely crowded living conditions and being able to live someplace more spacious, perhaps with cleaner air, you know, better sanitation, and so forth. As well as, of course, what happened with Henry Ford and thereafter, the idea of it becoming the motor of an industrialization that creates a prosperous working class. So those things are certainly possibilities. The question is,
and this is a very cynical question from the part of view of people in the developed world, can the world afford to let, well, to take the big ones, India and especially China, follow the same route we have? Can we afford it in terms of oil consumption, in terms of global warming, in terms of pollution? Or do we have to tell them, sorry, your path has got to be different from ours? Which we are telling them, and they're saying they don't want to hear that.
So one thing I learned reading your book is that approximately every decade somebody predicts the death of the automotive age.
Right.
Do those rumors continue to be greatly exaggerated?
Well, I can be a cop out here and say I'm a historian. I can predict the past pretty well, but not the future. I wonder. I mean, I think certainly there's the current generation of anti-automotive polemics that says all we have to do is, you know, build trains or shut down, you know, the highways or whatever, and everybody will happily give up their cars. This is coming from people who are not sufficiently appreciative of not only the fashionability but also the practicality of the automobile. And so those people are going to be disappointed, certainly over the next few years. And yet someday things are going to change. The fashions are going to change, and we're going to come up with new ways of organizing our cities, new ways of getting around that will substitute for one use of a car for another use of a car. And, you know, this machine will fade from the scene. I have no idea how soon under what circumstances, but it's not going to be with us forever.
The photograph of you on the inside of the book jacket shows you sitting in some kind of a car. What car is that?
That would be our old Subaru station wagon.
Oh, so is that your what is driving around in an old Subaru station wagon say about you?
It says I live in a place with a lot of snow.
Uh-huh.
I suspect Subarus are a lot more popular in upstate New York than they are in Texas because of the four-wheel drive. So around here they have the image of rural practicality.
Yeah, people like four-wheel drive down here, but they usually attach it to a big truck or an SUV.
Right. Yeah, that's a different fashion.
And did you hear from a lot of people about their dream cars when you were working on this project? Did everybody want to sort of defend their automobile to you?
Well, not so much the particular cars, but certainly I was exposed in one way or another to all of the arguments for the car, because I was exploring it through the arguments against the car. And so I became well acquainted with all the arguments for the car. And so I think I'm appreciative of those arguments. On the other hand, I don't like the intolerance of either the pro or anti-automobile extremists.
Brian Ladd is an independent historian with a PhD from Yale. His new book is called Autophobia, Love and Hate in the Automotive Age. Brian, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.